And now I have the pleasure of introducing Sean Francis. Welcome to WGXC Studio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. And Sean, Mr. Francis, or should I say, are you, what's your title of nobility? There isn't one yet.
It's not yet.
Senator.
No, Sean is
soon
fine.
Soon to be Senator Francis. That's a great name. It was, it's my middle name, actually, is Francis. And you are running for state Senate on the Democratic ticket against Kathy Marchione, who's a Republican, I'm assuming?
Yes. So,
okay.
I'm running on the Democratic
and
Working
what you're
Families
doing.
Party lines for the 43rd New York State Senate District. It's currently represented by Senator Kathleen Marchione, the Republican. And the 43rd Senate District covers, it's a pretty big district. I live in, just outside of Saratoga Springs, and it covers the eastern half of Saratoga County, a little bit of Washington County, virtually all of Rensselaer County, and all of Columbia County. So it's a pretty big district. In fact, this morning when I was coming down here to Hudson, I was up pretty early. It's about an hour and a half drive or so to get down here. And I'm running for New York State Senate because, like many people, I'm very tired of the corruption that's going on in Albany, the money that influences our politics, both at the national and state level. And everybody, if you look at this year's election cycle on the national level, you see a lot of people who are saying it's time for a change. It's time for something new. It's time for something different. You know, that was led to a lot of the success of Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary. And it is fueling a lot of the support for Donald Trump, despite his everything that he is. There's a lot of people saying we just want something different. And are willing to look to somebody like a Donald Trump. So regardless of the underlying ideology or the positions people think, people want change. And Senator Marchione has been in public office for 25 years, and I believe it's time for a change, especially we need somebody who's going to fight to get the corrupting influence of money out of politics, and that's a priority for me in this race.
Okay, so you're on the Democratic ticket. I noticed you also had some endorsements of some labor unions. I think the SEIU came out in support for you, and then there's another union, and you are also on the website a labor organizer. You work with unions, or what's your take on?
Yeah, so my background is after putting myself through college, I grew up pursuing baseball. I loved the game of baseball as a young kid and wanted to stay around the game of professional baseball and make my way to the big leagues if I could. And so after college, I went and became a professional baseball umpire. Went to the umpire school, got into the minor leagues, and spent over a decade traveling the country, working from the lowest levels of the minor leagues, rookie ball through A and double A up to the triple A level. During that time, I became involved with our labor union, the umpires labor union. Our union was on strike for half of the season, 2005, and for the first time I recognized that, you know, people think of baseball as American pie and, you know, part of our national culture, but it is a big corporation, Major League Baseball, giant multi-billion dollar corporation, just like any other corporation, and we minor league umpires were being treated pretty unfairly in terms of pay, struggling to pay the bills, struggling to put food on the table, yet this multinational business of Major League Baseball couldn't operate if there weren't umpires on the field. So that really opened my eyes, politically speaking, to saying, you know, people who work for a living deserve to have a voice in government and in other institutions. So I became involved in our umpires union, which led me to work in more of a national for a national labor union. And that's what I do today. Now that I'm not umpiring anymore, I work full time as a union organizer, helping people get a voice in their workplaces, organize unions in their workplaces, and negotiate good contracts, which provide for increased wages and benefits and working conditions for working men and women. So that's my day to day job. And now I'm launching from that into a political career, because that's the type of voice we need in Albany. And we need in Washington, D.C. as well, but we need more people with a voice, say, coming from blue-collar working men and women, not a political background or a legal background, somebody who's just a person of the people who says, you know what, regular men and women, they need a voice. And so that's why I'm running. And certainly Senator Marchione doesn't provide that voice. I mean, she's taking so much money from real estate developers and big corporations and big political backers, and she's lost touch with everyday working men and women, and so that's why I'm running.
Well, this sounds very, very interesting. And just about the money, I mean, the fact is we do need money, or you need money to run for office. It's just the game has sort of shifted in a way that you know, talk about money in politics. Mm-hmm. It's so funny how Donald Trump gets all these supporters because we need change. We need change. You know, he's anti-establishment. But at the same time, he represents more than any other candidate I've ever seen money in politics. Literally, mm-hmm. he is money in politics.
Yeah. And one of the very first presidential debates on the Republican side during the primary season, he was asked about it, and he said, I give money to everybody. I give money to all these politicians. You know what? When I call them 2 years later, 3 years later, if I need something as a real estate developer, they're there for me. That's pretty much a direct quote from Donald Trump. Mm. And in fact, he's given money to Kathy Marchione. So, I mean, that just shows you that, you know, he gives money and he wants something in return. And so we need to get away from that. So one of my key focus and I'd like to work on, and I will continue to fight until we make it happen, is publicly financed elections. Let's get away from a system where politicians spend 3/4 of their time calling people and asking them for money. If we publicly finance elections, now that would mean when you have an election, say for state senate, any candidate, whether they're Democrat, Republican, Working Families Party, Green Party, if you get access to the ballot, the state provides you with a check for X amount of dollars, whatever that is, and that's the money you use to run for office. And so, and then no longer can politicians take money, whether it's from a labor union or a corporation or an individual. Right. And if those big organizations, if ExxonMobil wants to get involved in politics, they can take out their own TV ads. They can do their own mailings and say, this is what ExxonMobil thinks. Instead of just writing a check to a candidate who can take out a false negative TV ad paid for by the ExxonMobil money, but ExxonMobil doesn't have to put their name on it. Mm. And if we can get to a system where we can publicly finance our elections, it's also a way where we can actually have third party and small parties have voices. Mm. Because right now you have two major parties and they dominate the political system. And if you won't, you know, if, and this is, you know, for some of the Bernie Sanders supporters out there, if you want to have a challenge to that two party system, if you want a real, say, Labor Party, Working Families Party, or Green Party that can stand on its own, and on the other side, Conservative Party or Libertarian Party that can stand on its own, a publicly financed system will lift everybody's voices up. So in this race, I'd be the Democrat. I'd have a certain amount of money. Kathy Marchione, the incumbent Republican, would have a certain amount of money. If somebody wanted to run on the Green Party line, they would have the same amount of money as me and as Senator Marchione. And three or four people could go out there with different voices. And that's how you take on the gridlock of the two big parties. You get the corrupting influence out of it. And then whoever's elected through that system, when they're in Albany and they're working on legislation, no longer will be, well, if I vote on this bill for it or against it or wherever I take a position, where are my donors going to be for my reelection campaign? Or are people who are opposed to this going to fund my opponent? That doesn't becomes an issue anymore, because no matter how you vote, no matter what you do as a legislator, you know when you stand for re-election 2 years from now, you'll have an opponent and they'll have the exact same amount of money as you. So the only thing you can do as an incumbent under a publicly financed system is do good work in order to advance yourself for your re-election campaign. Instead of just promoting the special interest causes so that you can get the big checks, so that you have so much money to flood out the next re-election campaign, do good work, stand for re-election, and then let the special interests spend their money on their own. That's what I want to fight for.
Publicly financed elections. It seems to be super common sense to me, but it's we've gone away from it for sure. And
well, you know, one of the complaint that you hear on the other side is, well, we can't afford it. You know, our government is already spending too much, and we're not going to raise taxes to pay for elections. Well, that's political speak by people who are in office who have the power now and don't want to change the system. The reality is this. If you ask any average person, is there wasteful spending in government? Everybody says yes. Now, we may disagree on what that is. The conservative mind view would be all that special interest, all that government bloated spending for social welfare programs. The liberal or progressive side would say, what about the tax breaks to ExxonMobil and the ultra wealthy and the Wall Street banks? The bottom line is there's wasteful spending everywhere in government. And why does that happen? It happens because Democrats and Republicans, progressives and conservatives, go into office and have to hand out all that wasteful spending in order to get the campaign checks coming back. If you move into a publicly financed system and you take away that incentive, you stop handing out the tax breaks for the ultra wealthy who don't deserve it. And yes, you actually can go in there and take away some of the waste, fraud, and abuse in some of the social welfare programs. The programs are good. There's certainly just waste, fraud, and abuse in them. If we can take that away, then we reduce the wasteful spending in government, and you'll actually net save money by spending some of that wasted money on elections, and then put the rest of the money in the state's coffers for education, environmental protection, and things such as those that would actually do good.
Like all the things that are suffering that we need most, like clean water and our kids to be educated and our elderly to be taken care of, our veterans to be taken care of. It's just amazing to me that there's always all this money to go to war, but when the soldiers come home, there's not quite enough money to take care of them when they're up in the hospital. There's like vets having to do these fund drives to like raise money for vets organizations. It's like pretty interesting. But then there's also, you know, forget about the tax breaks for the wealthy. What about getting some of them to actually pay their taxes at all? Like some of
exactly.
them for
exactly.
15 years straight, like billions of dollars potentially. And speaking of freight trains.
Yeah, we got one running by the station
here
right
comes
now.
A CSX train rolling through the 7th Street Park here in sunny, beautiful downtown Hudson on a Wednesday morning, tooting its horn. But it's very fascinating to me about the tax system. And it's funny because Trump turned it around to be like, yeah, the IRS, it's not the IRS's fault, but the tax code written by these politicians, that's the real problem. And he turned it around to make himself try to look like he's doing something good by cheating on his taxes and not paying for 15
right.
years. But the fact of the matter is the very, very wealthy in this country really don't pay a lot of taxes.
Well, I mean, that goes to
Warren Buffett. I just want to quote Warren Buffett
absolutely.
Saying that it's absolutely preposterous that his secretary pays more taxes than he does.
Yeah.
He's like, this is wrong. My secretary is paying more monetarily, not proportionally, monetarily. She pays more every year than he does. And he's like a billionaire.
Right.
So,
no, you're absolutely right. And that's what we're talking about here. That's wasteful spending. People think about wasteful spending, they think of the actual dollars that go out of the state's budget into governmental programs. But wasteful spending also means the revenue that we're not bringing in that we should, because we allow these tax programs at the state and federal level to benefit the upper 1% and the ultra wealthy. And so that's exactly what I'd like to tackle. We do need a more progressive taxation system. We need the upper 1%, the Wall Streeters that we bailed out a few years ago during the financial crisis, to finally start chipping in and pay their fair share. When we do that, we can ease the tax burden on the middle class and the working families that are carrying all of the tax burden right now, because the Donald Trumps of the world aren't paying any federal taxes and probably very little state taxes. And so how do you do that? It's very hard right now in the current system for politicians to go to Albany or Washington, D.C. on the federal level and actually enact the changes that Warren Buffett's talking about, enact the tax code in a fair and progressive and proper way, because the people that are writing the checks, that are funding their elections and reelection campaigns, are the Wall Streeters, the billionaires, the Donald Trumps of the world. So that is the hurdle that we have to get out of the way. You know, it's every few years we have these elections and politicians on both sides will say we need to do this, that, and the other thing. And then when they get in office, everything stays the same because both sides just flood their campaigns with cash. And so once we can get that, and I don't want to sound like a broken record here, but once we get the money out of the politics, then we can actually enact that fair and progressive taxation system. Then we can actually take on addressing, like you mentioned, clean water, which is a huge issue in this district right now, where it's also another very important reason why I'm running, which is Senator Marchione's failure to handle an extreme water contamination crisis up in Rensselaer County and Hoosick Falls. So, so that's why it's a priority for me. As I'm going around, people say, well, I'm worried about water. I'm worried about my child's education. I'm worried about the environment. And that's all true. And I'm worried about those things too. But until we can fix the system first, we're never going to be able to tackle those issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's all sounding very reasonable to me. And you look at Bernie Sanders, who came out with like the $30 donations from individuals, and he was amassing millions of dollars. He was neck and neck with Hillary on the amount of money he was raising, because he kind of had to compete to just get the ads out, to get to the debates, to do whatever. And but he wasn't taking $1 from Wall Street, and he was getting all this support. This is a guy who actually played by the rules.
Right.
And not only that, refused corrupt money, didn't take any of this dark money, you know, Citizen United stuff. He took $20, $30, $40 from individuals, and it's just absolutely record breaking. He got amazing support, amazing, you know, ratings that he would do better against Trump, like by far, than Hillary would. And yet, and still, he got his butt kicked by dirty, dirty tricks in the back room behind the DNC, just playing the same old corrupt stuff. So it seems like you're saying some wonderful things, but it seems like also, but if you take it too far, like Bernie did, and like he really was calling out these banks, those guys did not want him to get elected.
Right.
It seems like there's also like, how do you take on the inherent corruptness of the Democratic Party as well?
Yeah, there's certainly problems with both parties. I am not, my campaign is not being financially supported by the state Democratic Party, the state Senate Democratic Campaign Committee, or any of those parties. I'm running a true grassroots campaign. The difficult thing, you talked about Bernie Sanders, you know, $27 average contribution on a national level, that can work. And we saw it work well with Bernie Sanders. Yeah, he fell short, but it worked well because he can amass millions of $27 contributions. But beyond the presidential race, when you get down to local races and state level races like mine, I am also averaging, and I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but certainly below $100 average individual contribution. But it's, I don't have millions of those because there isn't millions of people that are investing
in 1,000 people in Washington County right now. There's more cows probably. I actually have two cows up at a Stone Meadow Farm in Washington County.
That's
right.
Great.
Now I love that area, but
yeah,
anyways,
beautiful.
Right, there's not a large population,
so that's why I am fighting for the publicly financed system, because you can't expect Democrat, Republican, conservative, progressive, Green Party, whatever the candidate is, you can't expect somebody on this local level to try to be able to raise the money to compete with, say, a Senator Marchione, who has $250,000 in the bank on local $27 donations. So that's why we need to get to the publicly financed system. And when we do that, you know, you break down the barriers of, you talked about some of the institutional problems and the corruption in the Democratic Party. It is not a Republican or a Democratic thing. It is on both sides. You've seen Democratic and Republican leaders in Albany go to jail in the last few years, both parties. More questions coming up about Andrew Cuomo's administration right now and the corruption that's going on there, and just in the last couple of weeks. When I look at Hoosick Falls, so here's a good example. I mean, you got Hoosick Falls, New York, is a town up in Rensselaer County near the Vermont border. A company came in over decades and polluted their water, PFOA.
Can I just interject by adding the funny irony that the chemical comes from Teflon, which is associated with some of the slick politicians who get away with this stuff. Sorry,
that's the first person I've heard make.
I just thought it was like, oh, the Teflon. So the Teflon politicians who are charged with cleaning up that water are now kind of getting away with stuff. But just PFOA is a highly toxic substance that's a byproduct of making Teflon.
Teflon pans, yes.
Okay,
exactly.
And they had a mill up there in Hoosick Falls, and they're finding it in the well water.
And in Petersburg, which is the town just south.
Okay.
And so the corporations have polluted the water, and now people are trying to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at that, you say, okay, my first thought is, how did that happen in the first place? And what are we doing to prevent it from happening again? That seems to me be common sense. Obviously, we're going to clean up the water. Well, Andrew Cuomo and Kathy Marchione have worked together to clean up the water. They've put filtration systems in place. They're getting blood tests for the people there. That's the least you can do. Nothing has been done to regulate these corporations that caused this problem in the first place and to prevent this from happening again, because people across the district have to understand that could happen here in Hudson. That could happen up at Saratoga Springs where I live. It could happen anywhere. There wasn't anything unique about Hoosick Falls. There's small factories and small manufacturing businesses all over this district. And what chemicals are they using? So, but why does that happen? It happens because these big businesses, these corporations, write the checks to the politicians and tell them, I don't want to be regulated. And so Senator Marchione, in response to this, put out one bill. The bill was to extend the statute of limitations so the people in Hoosick Falls could sue the company. Okay, that's fine. But what? How does that help me now that I've got this chemical in my body? Mm-hmm. Most mm-hmm. people in Hoosick Falls, it's a lower income, you know, mill town. These people don't have the ability to go out and hire high-priced lawyers. The government's job is to protect people in the first place. The government's job is to prevent people from being harmed. On the federal level, we think about that all the time with national defense. Protect us from things, you know, the average person can't protect us. We need a military. We need to be protected. Now, there's a whole, you can get into a whole other debate about, are we using our military too much for wars and intervention, etc. But at the end of the day, our government should protect us. Here at the state level, our government should have been protecting us from corporations polluting our water. That's a basic staple of life, a number one priority. And our government didn't, largely because the business council and the business lobby has written large checks, got a lot of people elected, and have been successful at keeping regulations from being put in place in the first place that would have prevented this. And Senator Marchione, to this day, still says, in a recent interview, she said, I do not want to regulate PFOA here in the state of New York. Why? Because she says, if we regulate it here in the state of New York, corporations and businesses that want to use this chemical will leave New York State, take their jobs with them, and go to New Jersey. You know what I said to that? Let the door hit them on the way out. Because at the end of the day, you want to talk about creating jobs and having businesses that put people to work. Well, if you're poisoning the water, you're not going to have anybody living there to work there. Right. You know, look at Hoosick Falls right now. You cannot, if you wanted to go buy property in Hoosick Falls, you couldn't get a mortgage from the bank. The banks have stopped lending for mortgages and for property purchases in Hoosick Falls. Businesses have been closing up and people are leaving the community. How is that creating jobs? You know, so, and on the bill that she put forward, which was a statute of limitations bill, again, allows people to sue. She put it forth at the beginning of the session. She did nothing with it all session long. Didn't talk to the leader Flanagan about trying to get it passed, did nothing. The last week of session, she holds a press conference on Monday morning, says, this is a priority, I got to have it passed. Tuesday, she meets with the business lobby. Tuesday night, at the dead of the night, she amends the bill and changes it, weakens it. But what's important about that is the session was set to expire, to end on Wednesday or Thursday, meaning there was not time for a newly amended bill to get back through the assembly, passed in the assembly, back to the Senate, passed in the Senate, to the governor. So by amending it at all, she killed the bill, prevented it from passage. The next morning when news broke that she did this in the dead of the night, of course the media and everybody in Hoosick Falls, including myself, came down on her. She said, I was doing that because I was afraid it wasn't going to pass in its current form. But then she amended it back to its current form, and then the thing passed unanimously. When asked by reporters, you said you had to amend it because it was in danger of not passing. When you unamended it, let's put aside the fact by amending it all, you guaranteed it wasn't going to pass. Let's put that aside. When she unamended it back to its original form, it passed unanimously. She then claims, well, that was because I really worked hard and I told my fellow Republicans in the Senate how important this bill was, we needed it passed. So here's my question. If that was the case, why didn't she do that first instead of amending the bill? Why didn't she try all session long to communicate to her fellow Republican senators how important the bill was first, instead of sitting there all session long doing nothing with the bill and waiting till the midnight hour? This, for me, is a stark example of her inability to do the job as a state senator. Put ideology aside, put Republican and Democrat aside. When something like this happens in your district, people have contaminated water, and that is how you handle legislation around this, that's your job. You're a legislator. You've got to pass bills. I think she should have done much more. But if this is the bill that you say is your priority, then where were you working all session long to make it pass? How did you let it get to the last days of session where, according to her, it was in danger of not passing? Then you didn't do your job all session long to educate your fellow members. This is your district, Senator Marchione. You should have been educating your fellow Republicans. Then amending it in the dead of night, guaranteeing it wouldn't pass, then coming back unamending it, and now trying to claim that you did great work to get, you know, it's a stark example of a career politician not doing their job.
kind of business as usual up there in Albany. You hear so much about the corruption in Albany. They say, I think Albany is the most corrupt state government Absolutely. In the country.
Yeah, well, I think there's a stat out there that says we've got more of our state legislators in jail right now than any other state.
And interesting.
That's pretty embarrassing.
And speaking of jail, we have a lot of jails up here. Probably not a lot, but it's probably not a lot of politicians in the jails.
There's a few.
Some people might want to change that. Yeah. But, you know, do you feel pressure from the lobby, from the correctional groups? Because we have a lot of jails. In mm-hmm. Columbia County, we have mm-hmm. a few. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Washington and Rensselaer. Mm-hmm. But what's your take about mass incarceration in New York State? You know, you have the New York City issues. Like, you will be voting on issues that affect New York City and yeah. vice versa. The typical one is gun control. Yeah. So in New York City, people freak out about the right to bear arms. But you're upstate where it's mm-hmm. like, we have a lot of hunters. I actually have a lot of friends who hunt who aren't like rabid mass shooters. They just like to get a deer every now and then.
Right.
And that New York City overlap. So I feel like mass incarceration is another one of the things where you're what you're experiencing on the street level, especially with people of color in New mm-hmm. York City. How does that affect how you vote upstate and those kinds of issues?
So you touched on two different topics here, okay. but yeah. That's fine. We have to recognize that New York State is a very big and very diverse state. There's very different worlds in New York versus, you know, the Mid-Hudson Valley versus the Adirondacks, Buffalo, another major city, Rochester, Syracuse. We can't go to Albany and always try to have a one-size-fits-all mentality. We have to recognize the diversity of our state, which is, makes us a great state. But we have to recognize that. When we legislate, we have to work on those things. When it comes to guns, yes, there is a lifestyle, especially upstate, of sportsmen and hunters that we have to recognize. I was just at the Clifton Park Sportsman's Club just the other night with Republican and Democratic candidates talking about Second Amendment issues. The fact of the matter is, Second Amendment exists, and we have to respect that. All law-abiding citizens have the right to keep and bear arms. But we have to recognize the dangers that can come from guns. And so we have to get, and this is my message to them, and this is my message in every group I go to, we have to have common sense around this. We got to have to start having conversations. Not the far right and the far left screaming past each other, real conversations. We have to recognize that law-abiding citizens are not the problem. We have to stop legislating the object and start legislating the behavior. We need to start increasing penalties on those who do harm instead of, you know, for example, the New York Safe Act makes certain rifles illegal if they have certain cosmetic features. The bullet still comes out just as fast with just as much deadly force, whether or not the stock, the collapse, it's a collapsible stock or a fixed stock on the rifle. I understand where some of this, from mainly my side of the aisle, is coming from. They're trying to prevent deaths, and everybody, including and especially gun owners, are as horrified about some of these mass shootings. But dangerous, sick, or violent people are going to do harm. So let's have some realistic conversations. I want to amend the SAFE Act. Let's keep in there the things for the background checks. We actually absolutely have to have reasonable, responsible, and effective background checks. The SAFE Act also has enhanced penalties for anybody who shoots a first responder at a scene of a crime. Absolutely. Everybody agrees on that. We got to make sure that people who are on terrorist no-fly watch lists can't access weapons. I'd like to see us and putting more resources and money into mental health awareness, education, training. Those are things that can have positive effects, and stop focusing on, well, this gun has a 12-inch barrel or a collapsible stock versus a non-collapsible stock. That's not solving the problem. The SAFE Act said you can't have a magazine with more than 7 rounds in it. Who's going to listen to that? Law-abiding people will listen to that because that's the law. If you're a mass shooter and you're going into a movie theater, are you going to say, well, I only can put 7 rounds in this magazine because that's what the state... No, of course not. So those are the types of common sense approaches that I think we need to take around guns. In terms of mass incarceration, this is obviously a huge problem. We have to stop. I think we absolutely have to stop privatizing the prison system in this country. It incentivizes putting people in prison from a financial basis. That's just disgusting and a wrong approach. We obviously have to keep dangerous people off the streets, but we also have to start finding ways to rehabilitate nonviolent offenders as much as possible rather than make incarceration the first option. That is a very big conversation that could take hours. I think the federal government has a role to play in that as well as the state government.
So where do you stand on the war on drugs and, say, for example, legalization of marijuana, mm-hmm. given that about 75% of the prison population are nonviolent drug offenders?
Right. And then that's exactly what we're getting at. Right now, we're dealing with an opioid crisis. And in New York State, you know, something like 50 or more percent of the opioid epidemic is here in New York State, and especially
it's insane.
Upstate.
I live in Dutchess County,
yeah.
And I think Dutchess County just took number one for overdoses. I lived there for 3 years,
yeah.
And I've not known directly, but I've met two, maybe three in 3 years. Young men who died of a heroin overdose.
Yeah.
Like that's just insane. In
it
a
is
tiny
crazy.
Little town in Dutchess County, like this is taking over. So,
right.
So that's definitely a part of it.
So we have to revisit this, you know, quote unquote war on drugs. Obviously it's not working in its current form. I'm not a fan of more legalization until we can get our opioid epidemic under control. Once we can get that under control, and I think that stems a lot from we have to talk about how doctors prescribe opioids in the first place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I said I was a baseball kid growing up. You know, I had plenty of sprained ankles. You know, there was a time where you'd go to the doctor, you'd put wrap up your ankle, put it on ice, and tell you to go take Tylenol. Now, because doctors are so worried about malpractice suits that they're going to they have a tendency to overprescribe medication. That's just, and then you get teenagers, and that's where it stems from. Teenagers who aren't, I mean, because this opioid epidemic crosses race, economic lines. It's affecting every community, inner city, suburbs, rural communities. It's affecting everybody, and that's a place where we need to start on that. We get the opioid epidemic under control, then we can start taking a look at where are the places that we can start reducing. You know, these mandatory minimum sentences, I think, is also a part of the problem of mass incarceration. We need to start tackling those. But the priority for me is this opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm. It's where is this stuff coming from?
That's
always a question I have. People don't want to talk about that. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, Afghanistan, I think, it's still coming from there. 90% of the world supply. But marijuana is kind of its own ball game. I've heard talk of the Cuomo administration decriminalizing and then medical marijuana. Massachusetts, same thing. They passed it, legal ballots, but it's all hung up in federal stuff. Where does marijuana legalization stand right now in New York State?
Well, New York State passed a medical marijuana program.
They did.
It is you can use it. It's one of the more restrictive medical marijuana programs that are out there, but there is legal medical marijuana. It's only in pill form. It's not a smokable form.
It's synthetic marijuana?
That I'd have to look into, but I do know that we do have a medical marijuana program. There is talk about expanding it to, you know, the smokable form of marijuana and some things like that. So we have taken a step forward. I am willing to continue to work on finding ways to expand that within the medical side of it. And then once we get the opioid epidemic under control, then we can start looking at, and also we'll have some time, to see how some of these other states who've gone to full legalization, to see the results from those. And so far it seems okay. But I'm not really ready to pull the trigger on that one yet.
Right.
But definitely an opioid epidemic. We got to tackle that crisis.
Yeah.
The expanding the current medical marijuana program, under the auspices of actual medical care is fine. Let's look at that and let's continue to do that. And then let's later on down the road, maybe take a mm-hmm. look at the full legalization, if that's something that has proven to work in other places.
One step at a time,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And I guess it ties into the policing, because I'm just thinking of, like, you talk about the military and protecting us and all that, and the police are also supposed to protect us, but you're hearing a lot of stories recently about young men, black men in particular, being shot, killed by police. And I would just think that the you know, the more liberal, progressive marijuana laws, for example, would be mean less policing is necessary because they're going after these petty things.
Yeah.
But what's your take on just everything going on with the policing? And how would you be voting on those kinds of issues? I mean, that's another touchy one.
Yeah, no, it's an important one. And this, to me, when I look at this situation, what I see is a lack of conversations. And you can look at a lot of different hot button items, whether it's abortion or taxes or, you know, guns, the drug issue, and now the policing issue. A lot of them are all intertwined, of course. But one thing that runs through all of them is we no longer have a situation where elected leaders and citizens can have real honest conversations with one another anymore. It's immediately everybody goes to the corners and the other side is completely wrong and our side is completely right.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't believe that is the case in most cases. In most cases, everybody's a little bit right. You know, one of my closest, best personal friends is an investigator for the New York State Police. He gets up every day and goes to work with the danger of not coming home. That said, does that mean that citizens should be under bombardment? Should law enforcement automatically go to use of force every time there's even a questionable incident? Of course not. So we have to get back to having real conversations about how can police do their job? How can they do it effectively? How can they protect themselves from the dangers of that's inherent in the work that they do? And also recognize that that doesn't mean that our citizens should be subjective to abuse, overuse of power, and obviously death at the hands of law enforcement. That's a difficult conversation to have. And again, not to bring it back to, well, to bring it back to the my original point, which is we don't have conversations anymore in government because of the money that influences it one side or the other, whether it's the PBA or the police unions, the correctional unions and the community groups rising up. And it draws politicians to say, okay, if I want to get elected, I got to get one side or the other. And so it doesn't make sense politically, I guess is what I'm saying, to go into some of these difficult items and say, hey, I want to work towards the middle. I want to work towards common sense. As a union negotiator, what I do for a day-to-day job, when I sit down and negotiate a contract, I've got members who want to get the most money they possibly can, right? On the other side of the table is a corporation, is a business who wants to give as little as possible. The best contracts that I've negotiated is when both sides give a little, both sides get a little, and everybody walks away feeling, maybe I didn't get everything I wanted, but we had a fair deal, we had a good conversation, we had a fair shake. We don't do that anymore in government. Whether it's the policing issue, whether it's taxes, the environment, abortion, guns, whatever the issue is, we don't have those conversations anymore to say, what is the common sense middle ground here to find solutions to make our communities better? And that stems from the money that influences and pulls politicians to one side or the other.
Yeah.
So you're not going to solve the police issue, policing issue, the violence issue, until you can have an environment where community leaders, community group leaders, local governmental leaders, state, federal leaders can sit down and say, let's have a real conversation about this.
And do you think the race issue comes into play here, conversations about race?
Well, certainly. I mean, certainly there's issues because you see these incidents largely occurring in communities of color. And so we have to address it. We have to address it head on. And we have to address it in a way that respects everybody. I'd like to see more training from a perspective of a community. I'd like to see us develop programs where community leaders, the local community leaders, I'm not talking about elected leaders, civil rights groups or community activist groups, community leaders can be brought in as part of the process with law enforcement leaders, with the local town, city mayors and state elected leaders, and work together on education and training for law enforcement around these types of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, police, law enforcement are highly trained and highly skilled, and 99% of the law enforcement that I know go out on a day-to-day basis, and they would rather err on the side of putting themselves in jeopardy than harming an innocent civilian. But unfortunately, the unique and awesome power that law enforcement has over the citizens and does have to have in order to keep the peace and keep law and order, when just a few do wrong, when just a few overstep, it creates massive problems. And so unless we can bring community leaders, local elected leaders, law enforcement leaders together around honest conversations, we're not going to solve the problem.
The bad apple phenomenon. Well, this is all, I appreciate you speaking on these issues. And was there other things you wanted to share? I mean, good luck in Albany. How's it looking? How's the campaign
going? So this year, more than ever, we have a real shot to win the seat. The presidential election year turns out Democratic voters more than any other off-year election. We have
Even this one.
And what people have to recognize is this year, this presidential election year is unique. And whether you're for Secretary Clinton or for Donald Trump or against, and I think there's a lot of people who are looking to vote against one of the other candidates more than usual in this year.
Or voting against both of them.
Right. Remember that there's a lot of other races down the ballot for Congress, for your state legislatures that are vitally important, and that these people, like myself, Zephyr Teachout, who's running in this area, these people are going to have as much, if not more, of a direct day-to-day impact on your life than the President of the United States is going to.
Hmm.
So think about that. And whatever you think about the top of the ticket, still come out and vote. I encourage you to vote for your presidential race. But even if you skip the presidential race and started voting on the races from below it and down, it is vital that you come out this year more than ever to vote. We got a really good shot to win this race. And so if people want to learn more about me, my website is Shaun-Francis.com. Shaun is spelled with a U, so it's Shaun-Francis.com. We have about 4 weeks left of this campaign. We are working hard. We're going to be opening up an office, a campaign office in this building. We just signed the lease today. Our Hudson office will be right here, right next to the park. So we're going to be asking for volunteers to come out to do phone banking, to do door-to-door knocking all across Columbia County, into Rensselaer County. We're asking people who can to come to my website and make a contribution. Again, $25, $50, whatever people can afford. $500, whatever it may be, so that we can get our message out. TV and radio is very important in these last few weeks, and we're making a push to get up on the air. We need help getting that done. And, you know, people often feel dejected by the presidential race. They say, well, my vote doesn't matter. In a state like New York, Hillary Clinton's going to win the state of New York. My vote doesn't matter. Your vote incredibly matters in a race like mine. You can make a difference in how we do things in New York State by electing somebody like me. So, don't get discouraged by the presidential race if you are discouraged. I'm excited to get out and vote this November, obviously not just because I'm on my ballot. It is a very important election. Get out and vote. But even if you're discouraged by the presidential race, recognize that there are races down ballot that will have immediate direct impact, that you can make a choice. If I win this race, or when I win this race against Senator Marchione, I'm not going to blow her out. I'm not going to win 60-40. I'm going to win in a narrow margin because this is a Republican-leaning district. I could win, you know, within a recount, within a handful of votes. Your vote in my race means a very, 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 will have a very large impact. So get out there and vote on November 8th. Go to my website, look me up on social media, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And thank you for having me in.
And especially good luck with the PFOA issue. I've been following that a little bit.
Yeah, remember that could happen anywhere. That could happen next week here in Hudson, anywhere in Columbia County. And when you look at how Senator Marchione handled herself with Hoosick Falls, you got to ask yourself, do you trust her to handle it if it happened again in your backyard?
And Teachout, she was looking at just, I digress again before we finish up here, but I found it fascinating. I forgot to bring this up when we were talking about campaign finance and big money in politics, is that her opponent is Faso, and he had these big corporations funding him, or one guy was funding so much. So she actually offered to debate the guy who was funding his campaign, because it's actually he's the one really running for office here, is this guy with all the money.
Right. I mean, if you say money is speech, right, this is what led to the Citizens United decision, which is money is speech. You know, my position and Zephyr's position, and she runs on the same, very similar platform as me, which is we need to get the money out of our political system first. And these guys who write these huge checks, And the Supreme Court said, well, money is speech. Well, if that's the case, my position is have them take out their own TV ads. Have them take out their own radio ads. Have them take out their own mailings and do their own things. Not write checks to a candidate to let the candidate say what the candidate wants. That's not the person who's writing the check speaking. And again, Senator Marchione here in New York has done the same thing, has taken tons and tons of money through the so-called LLC loophole here in the state of New York, which has allowed one big donor in Saratoga County to give her over $150,000. Even though our campaign finance limits say you can only max out at $11,000, this individual is given $150,000. So it's very similar. Zephyr and I are running on a very similar platform of getting that corruption out of Albany. And I think if people come out and vote this November, she's going to get elected, I'll be elected, and we'll actually be able to tackle that issue.
Okay. Well, once again, Mr. Francis, I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you very much.
To the radio. Welcome again to WGXC. This is At Issue, typically with Victor Mendolia, who could not be here today.
I wish Victor the best as well.
You know Victor?
I know Victor, yes.
Oh, okay. And we didn't actually talk about some of the LGBT issues and issues of homophobia and all the new stuff having to do.
Yeah, people need to go look at Senator Marchione's record on this because, okay, you know,
so
she...
I'd like to plug that, or could you please plug the last thing?
The last thing is, you know, we used to be represented by a Republican, Roy McDonald. He was one of the key Republican votes that passed marriage equality here in the state of New York. And because of that, Senator Marchione primary challenged him out of that seat because she's staunchly anti-LGBT, and that's not something we need in the New York State Legislature.
Okay. Well, thank you again. We're going to go to a tune here, and it's coming up on the 11 o'clock hour. Sean Francis running for New York State Senate. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
All right.